Welcome to the Climate Justice Forum here on KRFP Moscow. And we have a great show lined up for you tonight. We are going to gratefully welcome Soto Zen Buddhist priest Shoto Spring and planning organizer Mark Chavez of Compassionate Earthwalk. They will discuss the July through September 2013 spiritual pilgrimage that traces the Keystone XL pipeline route through the Great Plains from Alberta to Nebraska and demonstrates alternatives beyond the control mindset that creates such industrial disasters. Shoto and Mark will share information about the walk, associated spiritual practices, and experiences of tar sands resistance gathering. So this show broadcasts here on the blue light in a red state, KRFP Radio Free Moscow, every Monday between 7:30 and 9:30. You can listen to this live, of course, at 92.5 or online. And we're also going to cover continent-wide dirty energy developments and climate activism news. So we want to call out and thank our very generous anonymous listener who sponsors myself, your program host Helen Yost, as is KRFP DJ. Let's talk a little bit about the Compassionate Earth Walk that our guests are going to tell us about here. It starts on July 1st when the walkers will gather in northern Alberta in a beautiful place near the tar sands themselves. Probably, they say, we will arrange transportation from Edmonton, which you can reach by train or bus. We'll spend a few days gathering, centering, and making ourselves ready on both spiritual and practical levels. On July 5th and 6th, we join the fourth annual Healing Walk, and that's the Tar Sands Healing Walk at the Tar Sands site. This involves probably an afternoon-evening gathering of learning and listening, a day-long walk through a small part of the Tar Sands site, ceremonies, and a celebration afterwards. This walk is organized by four local First Nations women with allies coming from around Canada and beyond. They even came from Europe last year. We can offer a strong supportive presence. Our intention as we encounter this great wound in the face of the earth is to also open ourselves to the deep break in the human spirit which causes such things, and to meet that break in spirit without turning away. May this opening be the beginning of its healing and our own. Then we walk south along the pipeline route with meditation, ceremony, and community, continuing the healing process and sharing with those we meet. This is a pilgrimage, its goal, bigger than we can imagine. When its fruits ripen, we will recognize them. So they have several action groups working on this, one working on website graphic design, one on messaging and writing, another on walker preparation, another on fundraising, and another on support and logistics. So there's a lot of folks involved in this, although I would suspect that Shoto and Mark are the lead. So you can check out the Compassionate Earth website, which is just CompassionateEarthWalk.org, and find out a lot more about this walk. But of course, we'll be hearing more about it here later as well. So it looks like we have with us coming in on the line our guests. So we're guessing this must be either Shoto or Mark on the line with us.
Yeah, this is Shoto. Hi.
And this must be Mark Chavez that's with us on the other line.
This is Mark.
All right. Well, thanks to both of you for joining us. And we already sort of read a quick description of the Compassionate Earth Walk. But where should we jump in? Shoto, would you like to give us a personal overview of how you envision this walk to go?
Sure. How I envision it to go. I imagine a group of people. We will start by settling in a sort of short retreat, getting to know each other, doing some meditation, and sort of working out how the walk itself will go. You know, all those details, because we all come from different places, and I don't prefer to be the authoritarian. So, but still, I have a vision of it, and I've put it out there to give people something to work with. I expect that we'll have meditation in the morning and in the evening, that we will create some sort of ritual that will have to be a combination of what everyone brings. that will have council-type meetings maybe twice a day, maybe only once, and that the walking itself will be, it'll be a ceremony, it'll be a spiritual practice. And so when we're walking, which mostly is not about meeting people, but it's just about put one foot after the other on the ground, that's about being present with the earth and giving our full attention. So human beings have been taking a lot of stuff from the earth. You know, we've not just taken coal and oil, we've taken soil, we've cut down trees, we've been taking and taking a lot. And we're seeing the consequences of that. And so probably the fundamental movement of this walk is to move the energy the other way. So to express thanks for all we've been given and to actually give something back. And that what we give back is attention. We might decide that we do chants or some other things. And then we'll also, to everyone we meet along the way, particularly to the human people that we meet along the way, we're going to offer service and education and listening. It's like we need to listen to everybody, human and not. And we hope that when we come into towns, there will be community events, potluck suppers, and various kinds of conversation. So we're going to be sending out letters to towns and organizations and churches and unions and so forth.
All right. That sounds like a great bunch of arrangements. And we noticed somewhere that five walkers have already committed to being a part of this. And, of course, there's a lot of support roles that are necessary for such a long undertaking. Mark, could you tell us a little bit more about some of the specifics of this trip? And I guess you're recently joining the group of people working on this from and organizing from Denver, whereas Shodo is in Minnesota. Could you just give us some more ideas about how you think this whole walk will go?
Yeah, so pretty much we're from all across the country, and we've been organizing over conference calls, as you know, we all love to do sometimes. And so pretty much over the next couple of months, we're really working on putting together the final finishing touches on the route, and also putting together the kind of like a community outreach informational packet that we're going to be sending out to all those communities as we go through them. And really, as far as the walk is going to look, our plan is to have everybody convene in Fort McMurray in northern Alberta at the site of the tar sands around the 1st of July. And while we're up there, we're going to have all of the committed walkers and everybody within the group. We're going to do a little, you know, just gathering within ourselves to get used to each other and, you know, establish norms and all those good fun things that you got to do before you head out on a trip like this. And then we're going to join the 4th annual healing walk around the tar sands, which is going on the 5th and 6th of July. And then we'll probably spend the 7th of July traveling, and then starting the 8th, we'll begin in Fort Hardisty, which is where the Keystone XL pipeline is actually set to begin. And then we'll be walking roughly 15 to 20 miles every day, about 5 to 6 days a week, from there to southern Nebraska and Steel City, which is the terminal endpoint of the northern route of the pipeline. And along the route, we have right now we're kind of working on putting together how we're actually going to do the walk, but it looks like we're going to kind of do it like leapfrog style. So we're going to have people start out in the morning, get them to walk about 10 miles, and then hopefully by the time we hit 10 miles for them, we'll be able to move the camp halfway for the day, set up lunch with everybody. And then a second group of walkers is going to take on from there and actually walk the rest of the way at the next 10 miles, depending on, you know, the distance between communities and a lot of different things. We actually have a 35-foot school bus that is going to be accompanying us on the walk. It was with the group Pickup America, which myself and Davey Rogner, another organizer of this walk, were both a part of over the last 3 years, which is outfitted with 6 bunk beds and a couch, and it's just our mobile home and office that we've fallen in love with. So we're going to have that on the road with us. We're going to bring it to Denver to get it repainted at the end of June before we head up for the walk. And then once we get walking, that'll be kind of base command for the entire trip for the following 3 to 3.5 months.
So it sounds like you're probably just going to be walking along little rural roads and through relatively small communities. And are there opportunities for people to bring support or their feet and join this great endeavor?
Absolutely. We're planning that the website will always be able to tell where we are. Assuming that we're in communication, it will tell, and if not, it will be close. People can join us. People who are along the way might want to invite us to camp in their yard or stay at their church. They might want to bring a group to talk with us or, you know, whatever, and they might want to offer us a shower or the use of their washing machine, too. Things like that get interesting when you're on the road. Support. There are other kinds of support that aren't contingent on being physically present. Should I talk about those too?
Yes, please.
So one of the things that I've been asking people to do is sort of a spiritual support or energy support, you might call it. And so people with religious backgrounds might ask their community to pray for us and to pray for the goals for which we're walking, the general intention, which is the recovery of our human society or, you know, the part of our human society that's gotten disconnected from the earth, that we might reconnect and that we might stop doing some rather foolish things that we're doing. So prayers or well wishes of any kind. Of course, sharing information, letting other people know about us. They might want to walk. In the morning and evening, there's a time when people who practice meditation could consciously do meditation along with us. And that's anywhere between 6 and 8 a.m. and 8 and 9 p.m. And I'm trying to sit during those times. I'm not doing 100%. I usually get the morning time in. But it's like I'm sort of interested in having a field of energy supporting us in that way. And finally, of course, there's money. We can use money, and you can donate on the website. There are other things we can use, but they're hard to communicate, so.
Mark, do you have anything to add in terms of participation, both physically and fiscally?
Actually, I can't hear Shoto, so I'm listening to the past, what she just said. But I definitely say all of those things are, you know, great. I'm sure she covered it. The biggest, you know, like financial and tangible needs that we'll have from more of like the support crew side of things is the school bus. It does run on vegetable oil, but we always need diesel fuel as a backup and, you know, just for the sake of, you know, keeping the engine warm and stuff like that. And then, you know, to feed and sustain ourselves. And then, you know, if people can, if they can join us at any time, I'll definitely be on that support role, and I will be more than willing to work with people to find time and a way that we could get them out to the road with us if they can only donate you know, a couple of days, a week or two, something like that with us. So, you know, if they could come out and join for any amount of time, that'd be amazing. And one thing I'd also like to, you know, touch on is that just recently, I don't know if everybody knows this, but TransCanada just announced that they won't even begin construction on the northern route of this pipeline until 2015, which is amazing, and definitely shows that they're, you know, feeling the heat. And so I would say one thing that could really help to, you know, heal the wound that is the tar sands and everything is to, you know, really at the same time as focusing on this northern route and getting landowners engaged, is to really focus on the southern route as well. And for people who, you know, aren't already engaged with those groups financially or morally, you know, there's the tar sands blockade, Great Plains tar sands resistance, and there's a lot of groups that are working really hard to resist the southern route of this pipeline, which, you know, if we have two more years till they're even going to begin building the northern route, I think focusing on the southern route is going to be really important over the rest of the summer as well, along with engaging people on the northern route for the future.
Yeah, and that southern portion of the Keystone XL, the Gulf Coast Project, is really essential to stop just because it's like the last link to all the pipelines that are already in place, including the original Keystone Pipeline, not this new Keystone XL that sort of cuts the corner of a triangle. It's, you know, this southern route is the last link to get this tar sands oil down to the Gulf Coast. And then, of course, that allows all kinds of development at the tar sands, which is already really harming a lot of people and places up in the tar sands operations region. So we're curious because most folks in the United States come from various Christian or agnostic backgrounds. We'd like to learn a little more about your spiritual practices, Shoto, because you are, of course, now a full-fledged Buddhist priest in the Soto Zen tradition. And we'd like to understand sort of the viewpoints that come from that spirituality that are in marked contrast with some of the American spiritual beliefs that lead to folks sort of having a control mindset over nature. And I don't know if you could go into a little bit of detail about how we could all change our minds and look at nature in a much better way. We'd love to hear about it.
Sure. Well, first I have to say, having a background in Christianity, that the appropriate Christian attitude is that of stewardship and taking care of the earth. And so, although I like the Buddhist attitude better, there's nothing in Christian teachings that I'm aware of that entitles people to trash and destroy things the way is happening right now. So, having said that, the fundamental Buddhist teaching doesn't separate human beings from other conscious beings. It identifies states of existence, and it's thought to be particularly fortunate to be born as a human being, because a human being, you can become conscious, you can wake up and become free. So that's in the context of rebirth, which some Buddhists believe in, some don't, but it's sort of the background of the teachings. So, fortunate to be human, not because we have power, but because we can be conscious. Every other being on the earth is supposed to be seen as, like you should have the thought, one time, somewhere in my past history, this was my mother. And of course, this was said from a culture in which parents were very revered, and not quite the way parents are in this culture. But so you feel this great gratitude towards every conscious thing that you meet. Everything, okay, so to go more directly into Zen, not exclusively Zen, but the practice that really I belong to, everything in the universe gives me life, moment by moment. And I give life to everything else. Everything is always giving life to each other. So we're all completely interconnected. We're really causing each other. And my state at this moment, for instance, is caused by the fact that I'm talking to you on the radio over the telephone. And your state is caused by the fact that you're running a radio show and all these people are listening to you. And then, you know, whatever kind of room you're sitting in and whatever physical circumstances around you as well. So we don't exactly have an independent existence. We have a contingent existence. And then there's this consciousness that kind of looks out, and we experience ourselves as individuals, and we can't change that. I can't look out of your eyes or hear with your ears. So we experience ourselves as individual. But that thing called enlightenment is when we actually experience ourselves as not separate. And it's a fortunate experience to have that. But whether you experience it or not, that the understanding is that I'm part of the universe. I belong here. I completely belong here. We kind of think that we're outside of the universe. And sometimes we think that we feel really lonely and isolated about that, and sometimes we think we're in charge of it, but actually we're part of it. You know, we're neither isolated nor in charge. And that's like everybody wants to be at home. It's like the way things are is actually the way we would most like it. And all the stuff we do instead, trying to control things and stuff, it's trying to make up for the fact that we don't feel like we're part of it. So that's what comes to mind.
Wow, that's a great explanation. Thanks for the inspiration that we have arrived already, but we just can't seem to see, feel, and think that. Do you want to add to I guess your inspirations of being a part of this whole Compassionate Earth Walk, Mark, and what you anticipate folks to experience and ultimately accomplish through this whole I want to say healing walk, but it's the Compassionate Earth Walk. It's almost like an extension of the healing walk, actually, which we're all very honored and happy that all of you are working on.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, as far as you know, what has drawn me to this and my spiritual inclinations and all of that and everything, I was born and raised Roman Catholic, and I remember, you know, probably around the age of 14 or 15, my parents had been divorced for a while, and my dad took me aside one day, and he, you know, just kind of went agnostic after they got divorced, and he took me aside, and he just said, "Hey, son, you know, I don't want this to seem, you know, like I'm bashing on, you know, Catholicism or any religion in particular, but I just want to let you know that there are an infinite amount of amazing people and amazing ideas out there in the world, and I wouldn't want you to do anything to close yourself off from those." And so since then, I, you know, have adopted more of just kind of an agnostic lifestyle and thought process. And so that's kind of where I'm coming from, is I'm not very religious in any sense, and more in the sense that I'm part Native American, but don't have the connection with the lands that my, you know, people have come from, as well as the people there do. And so that's one thing that I'm personally working on a lot, and we are working really hard to incorporate a lot of the indigenous perspective into this walk, along with, you know, any other spirituality, really. We think, you know, anybody, you know, whether or not we, you know, practice the same practices are, you know, it's just as valid. And that's why we've chosen the, you know, a pilgrimage, is because pilgrimages, prayer, you know, and a few other things are omnipresent in every spiritual practice, you know, every spiritual or religious practice around the world. And so this is something that we can really all connect on. And it's a way that we can all harness our own spiritual inclinations and powers and direct them at the same common issue and the same common cause that we all believe in. And so I don't want, you know, it's definitely, you know, Shoto is definitely leading this in a sense, but we also don't want the thought of it being a Buddhist walk to deter anybody that might have other religious beliefs or spiritual beliefs. And yeah, I think that, you know, this is one step to healing our culture as a whole in a much larger sense. But really, for me, one thing is, you know, I am an environmental activist, and I've been working on the issues for 2 to 3 years now. And I do personally want to see the Keystone pipeline stopped and extraction of fossil fuels ended. And so that is a lot more of a tangible thing for me, is that I really want to see those things ended. You know, the expansion of the tar sands and the environmental racism that comes with all of it, and the people that are being impacted, and the negative health effects and just societal impacts on these people who don't deserve it and didn't even ask for it in almost every single instance. And so that's a lot more of what's driving me, is that personal feeling. You know, I've met people from Manchester in Houston, where, you know, Valero's refining and going to be refining the tar sands if this gets completed. And I've met people from the Beaver Lake Cree Nation up in Alberta, like, you know, from both ends of the spectrum that have been being affected, and feeling that personal connection with those people is really what's driving me. And I think Shoto definitely touched on it, that, you know, it's a part of that greater community, and we aren't the rulers of it, but we are all connected, and we all have that interconnectedness, you know. And seeing those people being put through what they're being put through is what's driving me to help them in any way that I can, coming from, you know, a privileged part of the society, you know, to give voice to the underprivileged and the marginalized communities is really what I'm trying to do the best that I can through this walk.
So let's talk a little bit about each of your experiences with different communities that are essentially resisting the tar sands. We know you, Shoto, have spent some time with the Unist'ot'en camp, and also you were at the recent hearing, the only hearing during this phase of regulatory consideration of the Keystone XL northern portion of the pipeline that happened in Grand Island, Nebraska, last week or so. And can you share with us ideas of inspiration for healing, for changing our mindset, for stopping some of these industrial practices that have come out of your experiences of these various situations, and just maybe explain these situations to us a little more so we can understand what the different parts of our tar sands resistance community are experiencing?
Wow, how long do you have? I think you and I met at the healing walk around the tar sands, and that was where I first started actually getting information. Before that, you know, I knew it was a problem, I knew it had to do with climate change, and I had a vision, so I was like, here I go. So I was up there, and I learned about the cancer, and I learned about the destruction of the environment, and that people can't hunt and fish and gather medicines and live in the traditional ways anymore. At the Unist'ot'en Action Camp, it was quite wonderful because it felt traditional, and I did the traditional practice of challenging people who wanted to enter their territory, so that in order to enter the camp, I had to speak with a group of people who were their leaders, really. And so it was personal. I came to know them, and things at the camp were done, and I think a traditional way. I still remember being in a women's circle around a campfire, and this woman comes running up the hill and says, "The men got a moose." And all the meat that we had there was prepared with traditional ceremony. And while we were there, they built a smokehouse, and now they've got... I mean, what they did was they built a log cabin in the path that the pipeline is supposed to take. And they're blocking a natural gas pipeline, which would be followed by an oil pipeline, which would go... It's just crazy, you know. Go to tankers going in places that nobody should go, going through mountain ranges. It's just an impossible scenario. So anyway, they've got this camp, and they've got this log cabin, people living there. Now they have greenhouses, they're growing gardens. People are going up there to help them work and build the camp some more. And I don't know what to say. I was overwhelmed being there. And then, well, on my way back, I met as many as I could of ranchers, farmers, and landowners. And, you know, I remember somebody who felt bad because he'd signed a contract, and I remember somebody who told me what was good about the contract that they had in Montana because of liability issues, and I remember somebody who said, "I'm sorry I signed the contract, I wish I could go back, I feel strongly, but I was born and raised here." And then some days later, I met someone whose great-grandfather founded the farm. And, you know, it's going to go right under their river where they do canoe trips and raise organic dairy. I also went out to support an action at White Clay on that trip. And I watched some people that I've come so to respect the people who are blockading and who are putting themselves in the front lines and taking risks with their lives and their bodies. And that, I think, was the first time I've been in a place where people were doing that kind of action. And they're just keeping at it, and they're going to win, however long it takes them. A month ago or something, I went to Moccasins on the Ground at Pine Ridge. And there are going to be a number of others. But this was a kind of amazing thing, and it was, the beginning of organizing the Lakota resistance. And they're preparing to blockade when the pipeline enters the territory that's part of their traditional territory. Their treaties are very strong. And I had such a strong feeling of community and family. The place was full of children. There were a lot of organizers there giving workshops who had come from the Texas Louisiana organizing, and there was a lot of traditional stuff, ceremonies and smudging and prayers and honoring of elders. And at the end, it's like there was a ceremony, and Mike Carlode and I were going to leave because the ceremony was for Indigenous people. And I was saying goodbye to Deborah Whiteplume, who I wanted to and hadn't gotten a chance to talk to her. And she said, "Well, afterwards." And I said, "We have to leave." And then it turned out that the non-Native people were invited to this ceremony. We did it in a different way at a different time. But so we got to make the commitment, and so I have a commitment to put my body on the line, too, in one way or another, when the Lakota people stand up against it. I've also been up to Red Lake, Minnesota. It's a different pipeline, but the Anishinaabe they're working on building a house, they're doing stuff. The tribal council is doing various legal kinds of things which aren't getting a lot of attention. And they're getting started. And so I feel like everywhere, this massive throngs of people are standing up, and you know, the indigenous people are able to stand on their treaty rights because all of these pipelines are violating treaties. Whereas the white landowners are standing on property rights, which just isn't as strong as treaty rights. And Mel Basil of the Unist'ot'en said, it's not that we have a right to this land, it's that we have a responsibility to the land. So our responsibility is to protect this land. And I saw that everywhere. And I was really impressed, I think especially at the Lakota gathering, with the generations. And someone said, you know, those people in the history books, those were our grandparents. So, and it, if it hadn't said it, it wouldn't have occurred to me. But, you know, I come to this as a first generation. You know, my parents were just making a living. And I've discovered connection with the earth. And, of course, we're in a time of crisis. And so I'm supporting as well as I can. But I've now several times been in the company of people who have been living connected with the earth for generations. And it feels like they really couldn't do anything except defend it. That's who they are. They're connected with the earth, so of course they defend it.
Wow, thanks for all those insights. And Mark, we're going to come back after a quick station break and ask you about the various communities of resistance that you have met and inspirations you have gained from those folks. So stay with us, and we'll be back in just a minute. So you're back with the Climate Justice Forum here on KRFP Moscow, and we are speaking with Shodo Spring, who is one of the initial envisioners and somewhat leader of the Compassionate Earth Walk that's going to be tracing the route of the Keystone XL pipeline from Alberta down to Nebraska, as well as Mark Chavez, who is one of the core organizers for this huge journey that'll take place between this July, right after the Tar Sands Healing Walk at Fort McMurray, into September. So, Mark, tell us a little bit about what you have learned from communities of resistance. I'm assuming mostly to Tar Sands, but since you've been an environmental activist for some time, perhaps other communities outside the usual sort of white male conservation paradigm of environmentalism.
Yeah, I would say my first experience with any form of resistance and real activism or anything, and I don't know, this could be debatable whether or not it was actually resistance or not, but it was actually with Pickup America, which was the nation's first coast-to-coast roadside litter pickup. And the group collectively spent 3 years walking from Assateague Island, Maryland to San Francisco, California. And I joined them in Ohio, and that was when I was first introduced to mountaintop removal and fracking and just about all of it. You know, I grew up in Washington in this nice green bubble, and so it kind of opened my eyes to a lot of things. And we were really, we were picking up litter, and the real message was, you know, trying to resist this culture of, you know, just consumption and the throwaway mentality of our society that we can, you know, consume what we want and, you know, don't look back, really. And so that was my first real experience with it, and that was very interesting. We met lots of people and helped organize some stuff in, like, St. Louis, and went through Appalachia and a couple other places. And then really recently I've been getting involved more with actual direct action and resistance groups, and I haven't personally been involved, but I've been working with an affinity group that's had a lot of people that have been present at tar sands blockade and Great Plains tar sands resistance actions and camps, and just working with them directly and hearing their experiences and learning from them and everything has really been helping me a lot. And I've been helping with one group here in Denver called Colorado Extraction Resistance, which has just recently been gaining a little bit of clout and has been doing some stuff, mostly organizing around resistance to fracking, which is really, really big here in Colorado. And through doing this, one thing that I've really started to realize is how interconnected all these issues are. And just, you know, in the sense for here in Colorado, for example, we have fracking is going on all across the state, and our state is threatening to sue people who ban, like, municipalities who ban fracking, but then fracking's been linked to a lot of health issues, a lot of water and air issues in these communities. And so really it's just about people trying to protect themselves, but our, you know, state and the corporations are both fighting people who are trying to protect themselves and their land. And just, you know, one of the really easy links that a lot of people don't really put together is that the tar sands, during the extraction process, they use about 2 barrels of liquid natural gas, or the equivalent of 2 barrels of natural gas for every barrel that they take out of tar sands. And our wonderful governor, who we like to call Frackin' Looper out here in Colorado, just recently led a delegation to northern Alberta to the tar sands, and the day that he got back, there was an article in the Denver Post saying that Colorado and Alberta had come to a quote-unquote clean energy accord. And we all really know that that just means that we signed a contract to sell a lot more of our natural gas to Alberta and to the tar sands. And so there's just like these really crazy connections going on with all of these different forms of extraction and resistance, where I think it's a really good way that we can all connect. And one way that we're seeing that is kind of as Shota was touching on throughout the Great Plains. I also went to the Nebraska hearing in Grand Island recently, and one thing that I noticed was how interconnected the resistance is becoming out there. And it was a lot of, you know, white landowners, but there is a lot of indigenous folk as well. And, you know, the way that I look at it is that the privileged white landowners are starting to be treated by our government and our corporations the same way that indigenous people have been treated for hundreds of years in this country. And now that that's starting to happen to the privileged people and the people who have those property rights and all of those things, they're starting to realize, you know, it's not each other that's the problem, it's the oppressor, and, you know, it's the people that are causing these problems that we need to be going after and we need to be targeting when we're resisting. And so, you know, there's the formation of the new CIA, or the new Cowboy Indian Alliance, recently in South Dakota, I believe, is where it started, and now it's spreading across the Great Plains, which is awesome. And there's a lot of that kind of resistance building up, and I talked to a lot of landowners there from Nebraska who just said they're not crossing my land. You know, they're feeling the same way as the natives with their treaty rights. It's their land that they own, and it's really up to them what happens to it. And TransCanada is trying and attempting to use eminent domain, but eminent domain is meant for the benefit of the people. And, you know, like an interstate, that usually will in some way benefit the individuals that are having land taken away from them. But in the case of a pipeline, it's not benefiting any of those people. And a lot of studies have shown that it's actually going to hurt a lot of people through the Midwest because of increased gas prices, and not to mention the potential impacts of oil spills, or tar sand spills in this case, and the overall consumption of the tar sands and how that's going to negatively impact our climate as a whole. And so there's a lot of these really great connections being made through throughout the movement, and that's, you know, happening from Texas up to Alberta. And so I haven't had too much personal experience with any of these blockades or direct action camps or anything like that, but I'm definitely hoping that this summer the Compassionate Earth Walk will be able to be involved, or at least be, you know, kind of vocal in helping those people and giving them at least our moral support and showing them that we stand in solidarity with them and in the struggle that they're facing.
All right. Well, thanks, Mark. Yeah, and we've experienced the same thing as well, being on the front lines, that there's just a lot of solidarity going on all across the country, and we're all doing everything we can to assist all the other folks that are fighting really toxic practices. And that is just more or less a manifestation of the worst parts of our shared humanity that we've sort of let run roughshod over the earth and our relationships with all the other beings in it. So it's time for us all to sort of rein that part of ourselves in, whether it's the corporations or the governments facilitating their practices or even our own consumerism. So let's wrap up, because I still want to tell folks in the last 15 minutes about a few of the resistance actions going on down in Oklahoma and elsewhere. But Shoto, can you share some last words with us about just your hopes and prayers for this Compassionate Earth Walk, and perhaps how people can contact you or get involved, and anything else you want to share about this?
Sure. Boy, there's too much to say. My hopes are that people will wake up, that not just that we'll see that consumerism doesn't work and we have to quit, and not just that they'll see that the jobs people get from pipelines aren't worth the devastation, or that they'll see that the involvement of the government with the corporations is, well, real, that it's a problem, you know, because that's a whole extra topic. But also that they will see that there's a home to come to, and that organizing our lives around control is not what works, that there's something better to do than that. It's scary for me to say that, because we've gone so far in the direction of climate change, not to mention pollution and poisoning, that I'm no longer certain that we can pull out of it. But then, and I go, you know, I went to the hearings and I said, stopping the pipeline is not contingent on developing alternative energy. We need not to use coal, natural gas, or oil, and uranium is monstrous. And that means we actually all need to change our lifestyles, and that means what we normally call hardship. And I could proceed in that direction, but I will say the fact that I wish something that will cause a lot of difficulty in the immediate realm, in order to save life on the planet, human life and other life, and so that my grandchildren can have a world to live in, and everybody else's grandchildren too, and the children who are suffering right now, it's pretty intense. I get pretty intense about it sometimes. So I would love for people to join us. The website is www.compassionateearthwalk.org. There's a Facebook page, Compassionate Earth. On the website, you find my phone number and email address under contact. And so you can get everything there. I don't mind giving my phone number over the air. It's 507-384-8541. Don't call me at night. And I hope we have a lot more walkers and all the other kinds of support, too. So, Helen, thank you for a really great interview.
All right. Well, thanks to both of you, Mark and Shoto, for being with us and sharing your perspectives and plans. And, you know, you can expect at least a few people, I'm thinking, from the activist communities in Montana and Idaho to be with you somewhere along that portion that goes through Montana and maybe even further south than that. And again, we just want to thank you for being with us. And hopefully, you know, after the walk, we would love to invite you back and hear the whole story about how it went. So thanks again.
Sure.
So again, you are listening to the Climate Justice Forum here on KRFP Moscow. Thanks for joining us. And we hope that you will as well next week. Thanks, everyone. Have a great night.